and welcome back. February now, and since midwinter is traditionally a time to sit by the fire and tell tales of love, death and daring deeds, that is exactly what we'll be doing today. The times being as they are, we are all still scattered, and Slightly Fox editor Gail Perkis is in Devon. Hello, Gail.
Hello.
Stephanie Allen is in West Sussex.
Hello.
Anna Kirk is in London.
Hello.
And finally, there's me, Philippa Lamb in Cambridge. Now, Hazel, having been with us for every single episode since the start of the podcast, is taking a break. But how are you three? Any news?
Well, in the middle of the third lockdown, there's practically nothing to say.
I know what you mean.
But the day-to-day running of the offices is going on and editing is continuing and I've got much more time to read, which is lovely.
Yeah. Steph, all good with you?
I've already dropped one of my New Year resolutions, which was a book a week. But I've decided
well, that's pretty slack.
3 books a month. That's my aim now for the rest of the year.
Anna, that you're leading the urban life like me.
Yes, as Steph says, it's, you know, more of an opportunity to hunker down with reading. And as opposed to Steph, I wasn't trying to kind of aim for a book a week, but more just trying to read for at least half an hour a day, which I'm mostly holding to. Yeah.
I'm reorganising this massive bookcase that we built in the house during lockdown, so that's keeping me occupied. But as promised, we have timeless tales today as we venture into classical literature for the first time on the podcast. And if you are thinking that Homer and Ovid and the like are wordy and dull, our guest is here to question those assumptions and also to show us how their work did lead on to much of the great later literature most of us, I think, know far better. Dr. Daisy Dunn is an award-winning author and classicist. She arrived in the literary world with something of a bang in 2016 when her first book, Catullus's Bedspread, was published about the life of Rome's most erotic poet. Her most recent books, all published, I think, in 2019, are In the Shadow of Vesuvius, The Life of Pliny, 100 Stories from Ancient Greece and Rome, entitled Of Gods and Men, and for absolute beginners, the Ladybird expert book on Homer. Daisy, thanks so much for being with us.
Hello, it's my pleasure. Lovely to be on.
Where are you?
I am in Surrey currently, the London side of Surrey.
Leading a quiet life like the rest of us.
Very, very quiet life, a strange existence, but you kind of get used to it, I think, as a writer. You spend so much of your time at your desk. I think the only difference is not being able to go out to a library and actually get the books that you're kind of used to borrowing.
We are delighted to have you with us. Thanks so much. I thought we might kick off by defining our terms. Ancient classics, what do we mean? One definition I saw, all written before the fall of Rome. Would that be your definition?
Yeah, I guess that would be a fair definition. I tend to focus on stuff that's been written before Christ and then up to the sort of first and second and third century. That's kind of the golden age of classical literature.
Should we slay the elephant in the room that classical literature is really strictly for scholars?
See, I find this a very irritating myth because I think most of us probably encounter ancient literature in some form or other when we're children. We read stories drawn from Greek myths, whether they're about Hercules or Odysseus and the Cyclops or, you know, the Trojan horse.
Yeah.
And I think you think that these are wonderful. They don't seem scary whatsoever. I think it's only when you become an adult that the approachability of those stories seems to fade away a little bit.
So we're going to have to pause there for a moment. Whose dog is that?
I'm just going to send him out of the room.
Sorry, Daisy.
I'm amazed because I've got Stanley lying on the sofa at the moment. Mercifully, he can't hear Maggie, otherwise he'd be going as well.
Yes, of course, because you're on headphones, aren't you?
Hi. Hello,
Steph.
Sorry about that. She gets in when I don't even know she's in here. Suitably admonished.
Daisy, I first came across you. I read Catullus's Bedspread, your first book, when it came out. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it would not, I have to confess, be the sort of thing I would generally have read, but I was taken by the reviews. I picked it up. I really enjoyed it. I'd have to say, erotic poetry is not a bad way to get readers' attention. It was a spot choice.
Oh, thank you very much. Now, I think, Catullus and erotic poetry in general, it's always going to capture the imagination. It's timeless in its way. And it's the sort of thing I remember sort of discovering Catullus at school when I was about 17. And that really sort of sparked my interest in classical literature more widely because it seems so immediate and it seems so easy to identify with, especially when you're a teenager, you're kind of discovering love and heartbreak and all these kind of emotions for the first time.
Yes, the nice thing about your book is you read about Catullus, this young man, and his life. He's very human, fallible, foolish even. Just give us a little sense of Catullus's life.
Well, he was growing up at the end of the Roman Republic, so in the 1st century BC, and he came from quite a well-to-do family. But he fell in love with a married woman, or at least he professed to in his poetry. And this was incredibly difficult for him because she was sort of the completely unobtainable woman. And he was writing these poems for her, and eventually they had an affair, and then she abandoned him, and he was completely heartbroken. So you get this whole sort of arc in his poetry of this story of this great love affair, you know, his sort of pining for her, and then his desire, and then his absolute hatred of her when she turns her back on him. Supposedly she has an affair with one of his friends, which makes the matter even worse. So I think you read these poems, and they could have been written yesterday, many of them. He wrote the famous "I Hate and I Love," and I think so many of these poems, you just take these lines and they've appealed to people for sort of generations. And I sort of Byron is very, very taken with them. Alfred Lord Tennyson being really interested in his poetry as well. Lots and lots of poets in Catullus's wake have sort of picked up his verses and kind of taken them in their own direction, but also found something in them that obviously rings true. And I certainly felt the same way when I was writing about Catullus and his life.
People who are new to this area of literature, you think they should start with Homer?
I do. It can feel quite remote. I think if you're used to reading, I don't know, Evelyn Waugh or Charles Dickens or Kazuo Ishiguro, you can kind of think, oh goodness, this is a bit scary. I'm not quite sure where to begin with this. There are lots of different places you might dive in. And I think that Homer is always a good place to start because Homer marks the beginning of Western literature. And you've got the Iliad and then you've got the Odyssey, which is kind of its sequel. I'd actually say begin with the Odyssey, because really it's the first great adventure story in the Western world. It's the story in which you meet the Cyclops, you meet all these wonderful creatures and monsters, and it eases you into the era of heroes. It's you know, a very, very enjoyable story in itself, and there's nothing about it that's difficult.
So it's interesting you say that, Daisy, because that is exactly what I did a couple of years ago. I hadn't read anything in this genre at all, and I read the Odyssey. And I absolutely loved it. It was cracking and it really inspired me. And I freely admit I went for the Odyssey because the Iliad sounded kind of off-puttingly complex.
It's a very different kind of poem, the Iliad. I mean, it's a lot more sort of on the battlefield. It's to do with warfare. It's to do with the sort of harsh realities of war and the kind of the impact that it has on other people. I think the Odyssey in some ways is a bit more uplifting as a story. But I think when you sit down and you've read the Odyssey maybe once, maybe twice, and then you come to the Iliad, I think you come to it with a, you know, slightly more knowledge and preparation for the kind of values that these heroes kind of live their lives by.
And Daisy, yeah. Which, I mean, there have obviously been multiple translations. Who would you recommend?
There are so many really, really good ones. I mean, I think my favourite of the Odyssey is Emily Wilson's, which was very, very recent. She really captures just with absolute clarity the sort of grandeur of Homer's poetry. And I think with the Iliad, I've always loved Evie Roux's translation, which is kind of a classic, if you like.
It's the penguin one, isn't it?
It's the penguin one.
Yeah. And are they translated as prose or as verse?
So Emily Wilson did hers in verse, though she hasn't tried to replicate the ancient meter, which is a kind of dactylic hexameter. She's put it in a different meter, which has a very, very beautiful sound to it. I think all of these things should be read aloud. I love doing it at bedtime, you know, a couple of pages.
I mean, Gail makes a good point. I think it can be off-putting, the idea of reading what is effectively a massive poem. And if you're used to reading prose, that does seem like quite a big step. But that, I think, probably was the revelation for me, that when I read The Odyssey, I realised it's like reading a thriller.
Well, it is absolutely a rip-roaring story, isn't it? I mean, well, they both are.
Dull they're not. Daisy, you've got a companion volume, haven't you, that you recommend reading? Jasper Griffin's?
Yes, this is a book, Homer on Life and Death. I kind of see this as the perfect book to read alongside either the Iliad or the Odyssey or both. It was written in 1980. Jasper Griffin was one of the great dons of Oxford. He never lost sight of what it was like to actually come to Homer for the first time and how bewildering it can be. I think romantic's not quite the right word, but I found it a very sort of affecting and memorable book on Homer's poetry.
Now, you mentioned earlier that Homer's characters laid the foundations for everything that came later. Can you talk a bit about that for us?
Yes. So with all of classical poetry, and you're looking at Catullus or whether you're looking at Ovid or anyone else, everyone's constantly, when they're writing, looking back over their shoulders at Homer and his characters. And what you find is that much of classical literature is concerned with reviving the characters that Homer created, looking at the aftermath, what happened to those characters after the Iliad and the Odyssey.
The sequel, in fact.
Almost the sequel. Sometimes they'll go the other way. Sometimes they'll look at the prequel. Where did these characters come from? And they'll develop. If you look at the sort of the Greek tragedies, a lot of the poetry, you look at the Aeneid, which is kind of the Latin equivalent to Homer, written in Rome. All of these are engaging directly with the storylines that Homer had created, with his characters, and also with the values, and often they're sort of playing with those values and they're questioning them. And what Homer was known for is creating this sort of great body of heroes on the battlefield. They're men, they're on the battlefield, they are fighting for their family, they're fighting for their territory. But a lot of them are incredibly flawed at the same time. And you find a lot of authors revisiting these characters and picking away at their flaws and trying to explore what drove these characters and were they really quite as heroic as you might sort of come away from Homer believing them to be.
What's your favourite modern day version of the Iliad or the Odyssey? I loved Pat Barker's Silence of the Girls. And years ago, loved The Hobbit, which I always gathered was based on the Odyssey.
Funny enough, I was just about to say I loved Pat Barker's The Silence of the Girls. I think that was a brilliant engagement with Homer and sort of trying to look at the other side of the world that Homer created. She very much approaches the story from a female perspective.
Mm. It is an extraordinary book, isn't it? Because it's basically the story of another queen who's been captured, Briseis, who's trapped in the Greek camp outside Troy, and she's the bed slave of Achilles. The way Pat Barker sort of captures the daily drudgery of the camp and then the sort of horrors of conflict on the battlefield.
Yeah, I would actually add to that Alice Oswald's Memorial, which she based on the Iliad. That was more focusing on all of the individual named characters whose deaths are mentioned, but their stories aren't, and it's to commemorate all of those other characters, and that again brings the true cost and horror of war to the forefront. And Memorial is, she subtitled it as an excavation of the Iliad.
I think that's a really interesting angle to explore it from, because I think one of the things that Jasper Griffin says in his book, he kind of makes the point that all these heroes that Homer describes, they're all sort of aspiring to the same thing. They don't want simply to live and to die, only to be forgotten. They want to earn the eternity of the gods through deeds so great, so memorable, and so worthy of being preserved in men's poetry that they overcome their mortality. And Griffin makes the point that when a soldier dies, Homer names him. He gives him some kind of biographical detail. He sort of says he came from this town or his wife was called X, Y, or Z. He was saying with sort of Alice Oswald, it's the same idea of making each death, each life and each death matter by creating some detail about it.
There has been a lot of discussion, hasn't there, about female voices in the classics. I mean, is it right to say that most surviving works of this sort of literature were written by men? Is there anything actually written by women that survives to us now?
You're completely right to say that most classical literature surviving does come from men. We have exceptions. So Sappho is the greatest exception. We've got lots and lots of fragments of her poetry, but very few complete or anywhere near complete poems. But those poems in themselves are really, really beautiful, written in the 7th century BC, so not that long after Homer. And they really give an insight into life as a woman. And she seems to have had her own poetry school of girls who she's teaching to sort of sing and compose these poems. She was living in quite a sort of febrile time on the island of Lesbos, and she was sent off into Sicily for a time. So we know that women were writing it. It's just one of those sad things that just hasn't been preserved.
It's interesting that you know they were writing it. I wasn't aware of that. I mean, obviously, there is a lot of discussion right now about female voices in the classics, and we had Atwood's book, didn't we? You know, giving voice to women who are silent in these works. I mean, I'm intrigued by this because I do wonder, I mean, is there any danger about imposing current perspectives on these works and kind of muddying the waters around them as analysis of the original text?
I worry a bit. I think especially when I talk to young, I often talk to students, and I get really lots of very, very impassioned responses to Homer's characters in particular. So someone will say, you know, Achilles, there's nothing heroic about him whatsoever. You know, he's a serial killer. He's a rapist. He's a whole list of adjectives which Homer would not have applied. And certainly in the time when he was writing those words, they don't sit naturally with the characters sort of as created in that time frame. I think there's so much that we can impose from our standards. It's very difficult to come out of that process looking upon anybody in a positive way.
Indeed. And not just in classical literature.
Yeah. With anything, exactly. Yeah. And I think if that turns you off the literature, that could be quite dangerous.
Yes, and simply condemning people by applying modern day morals just doesn't really get to the heart of why they behaved as they did, the society they were operating in and the imperatives that drove them.
Well, it's revisionist, isn't it? But I think yeah. the stuff around women's voices that's being produced now, I think is really interesting. But I suppose what I feel I would like is a clear division between that as an interesting evolution of the work versus that as an actual interpretation of the work, as Daisy said. Should we move on? I mean, Steph raised a very good point, and we got into it a bit, about later work, 20th century and 21st century work that kind of stemmed from all this. And I know you, Daisy, you're a big Mary Renault fan, aren't you?
I am. I love Mary Renault. I think we were saying earlier, sort of most surviving works of ancient literature written by men, but I'd actually say some of the greatest modern historical novels which are set in the ancient world have actually been written by women. And I'd say that Mary Renault remains queen of them all.
I read Mary Renault as a teenager, and that probably was my very first introduction. But for people who haven't read her, Daisy, I mean, tell us why you're such a fan.
I first came to Mary Renault through her sort of biography. I should say that Mary Renault is actually her pen name. Her actual name was Eileen Mary Challens. And I came across her because I've always been interested in sort of the history of Oxford. And she studied there in the mid-1920s. She studied English, and she was quite a sort of colourful character. I remember being really taken by a description of her practising dagger throwing in her free time. So for anyone who does that, it's going to be an interesting character. It's absolutely worth reading. I think she was the daughter of doctors, and after Oxford, she trained as a nurse at the Radcliffe Infirmary, and that's where she met her long-term partner, Julie. But later in her life, she returned to the classical literature she'd obviously enjoyed in her youth and started writing these fantastic novels. And I'd say that the first Greek novel that she wrote, The Last of the Wine, is my absolute favourite. It was published in 1956. And it's set in probably the most interesting period in Greek history. It's set in Athens during the Peloponnesian War, and this was a very, very protracted historic conflict between Athens and Sparta and their various allies, and it lasted almost 30 years, and it caused absolute devastation, not least because in the second year of the war, a terrible plague broke out and killed a very significant proportion of the population, including Pericles. The novel kind of takes all of this in. The protagonist of it is a young boy called Alexius, and he is from quite a sort of well-to-do family, and he's lost several relatives to the plague. It's kind of a coming-of-age story in many respects. He's growing up and trying to sort of find his way through this very, very fraught time.
I mean, her books are intensely readable, aren't they? I mean, they're fantastic stories, and the characterisation is second to none. I mean, Anna, Steph, have you read any Renault?
I haven't before, but now I very much want to. They sound great.
I think she's very unfashionable now, isn't she, Daisy? She was old-fashioned when I was a child. But worth digging up, I think.
Absolutely, because I think there was a certain controversy being published in the 50s. She was writing a lot about love between men and boys. Yeah. I mean, this is a key sort of aspect of social history of Greece. This was part of life. And she didn't shy away from it. And I mean, she didn't write about it in a kind of lurid way at all. It's very, very sensitive, her treatment of it. I mean, you even find, I think, The Last of the Wine is a reference to, in part, this boy, Alexius. He loses his uncle, who contracts the plague and takes hemlock. And as he dies, he writes the name of his lover, who happens to be a man, in wine on the floor. And this is a kind of a process that Ovid actually wrote about as well. It's something that lovers used to do in the ancient world. They used to write messages to each other in wine on the table. And it's sort of very, very romantic, so they can be kind of erased or smudged very, very quickly and wiped away, but sort of intended for the eyes of the beloved. And it's through details like that that I think Renault really explores the relationship between men in a sensitive way. That in itself, I think, makes these kind of books probably more readable now than they were in the 1950s when they were first published.
Daisy, what about people like Suetonius and his history of 12 emperors? I mean, we're getting onto the Roman period now.
Yes, on the Roman side, Suetonius is my absolute sort of number one place to go, because I think Suetonius wrote these very sort of short biographies of the 12 Caesars. They run from Julius Caesar through to the Emperor Domitian. And they're kind of quite short biographies all held together in a book. having written a couple of biographies myself of Catullus and then sort of more recently of the two Plinys, I always really appreciate the challenge that comes in summing up someone's life in a way that's satisfying for a reader who's never met and maybe never even heard of that person. And I think what Suetonius did really, really well was to anticipate what his reader really wanted to know about somebody. Yeah. You know, everything down from sort of the way they dressed to their eating habits, their sexual habits, their tastes, how they felt about their receding hairline. These are the kind of little details which I think really make a fun book. Suetonius, he was made the head of the libraries at Rome. So that gave him access to a whole host of imperial archives when he was sitting down in the early second century to compose these lives of Rome's rulers. The knowledge of that fact is what makes the book itself so jaw-dropping and so surprising. You sit there, you read it, and you think, gosh, these stories really, really do defy belief. Domitian, was he really, really so cruel that he sat at his desk skewering flies with the end of his pen? Or...
Well, I believe all this, Daisy, because I've read Robert Graves, you know, Claudius. It's all in there, isn't it? I mean, this is all...
It's all in there. And you know, Robert Graves, I'm a huge Robert Graves fan as well. And he published a fantastic translation. I think it's the Penguin translation again of The 12 Caesars by Suetonius.
But a lively read.
A very, very lively read. Yeah. You don't go in reading them as gospel. They're giving you sort of insight into life in Rome. And I think there are certain details in there where he says about taxes, for example, or particular games or public events. These are probably quite accurate. You often find them sort of supported by what's written by other people, sort of poets, for example, like Martial, writing in a similar kind of period. But a lot of it's got clear entertainment value.
And presumably that translation, you know, sparked his two novels on Claudius. In fact, funnily enough, we've got a very good article on I, Claudius and Claudius the God coming up in the summer issue.
Oh, they're great. I loved those books. I've read them several times. So, I mean, you could read them as a teenager, can't you, Daisy? I mean, they're absolutely gripping. The terrible stuff that people do.
Absolutely. Yeah, I remember really getting into them as a teenager. A lot of plotting, a lot of, again, talking about women, very, very powerful women. And I think in a lot of cases, this probably isn't exaggerated. A lot of women having huge influence upon their sons who are the rulers and really sort of pulling the strings.
And we've had other pieces on the reinterpretations. Margaret Yourcenar's wonderful book, Memoirs of Hadrian, which is absolute classic. She's writing as if she was the emperor. It's extraordinary, isn't it, the way that, you know, modern writers keep returning. I mentioned Alan Massey's trilogy on Caesar and Augustus and Tiberius. And more recently, of course, we've had Robert Harris's trilogy on Cicero, which is a wonderful story of power and politics and the way in which the Roman state operated, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the Robert Harris, I have to say. I actually really like the last one as well. It's a dictator.
Yes.
I can't remember the titles, yeah.
And what did you make of Pompeii? Because having written a biography of the Plinys, Pompeii, which is essentially a whodunit, isn't it? But I mean, he must have drawn very heavily on Pliny to write that, as you know, the eruption of Vesuvius and everything that followed from it.
He did. I've read Pompeii a couple of times. I reread it while I was writing my book about the two Plinys, because they're the only two people we really know about who were caught up in this absolute horrendous disaster of the eruption of Vesuvius. And as I was reading it, I was just sort of recognising all these things. I'd found myself in the sources, been reading, you know, earlier that day in Latin, and sort of realising how much research had gone into that book. And that's really what elevates these books. I think it's sort of doing the groundwork first, picking out all these sort of very interesting details which have come down to us in the sources and then giving them new life.
Yes.
Daisy, you were talking about Suetonius and Nero. Take us on that journey through Nero and Petronius and talking about the Satyricon.
Yes, so Nero, I think he kind of emerges as one of the most colourful characters, as you might expect, from Suetonius's book, his Arbiter of Excellence, which I think it sounds the most splendid job title.
That's what Gail does, basically. Gail and Hazel, I think, are arbiters of literary excellence.
You're very kind, Philippa.
So the Arbiter of Excellence, in this case, Nero's one was called Petronius. And sadly, he lost his life under suspicion of plotting against Nero in a conspiracy that was uncovered in Rome. But before he died, he wrote the most marvellous comic novel. I don't think it's too inaccurate to describe Petronius's Satyricon, as it's called, as an early comic novel. There's the most famous part of it is known in Latin as the Cana Trimalcionis, which translates as the Dinner of Trimalcio. And it describes this really incredibly lavish dinner party hosted by a former slave called Trimalcio, who's earned his freedom and he's found his fortune through exporting various goods. And he's determined to show off his wealth to his friends. But The trouble is he's very, very ignorant. I mean, he doesn't know anything about history. He doesn't know anything about the Trojan War or the Hannibalic Wars or any of these kind of events in history or art. He can afford all of this stuff. He can afford all these wonderful paintings and things. But when it comes to actually explaining them to his friends who've come round to join him for supper, he can't do it. He kind of shows himself up the fool that he is by mangling all of his facts. And you kind of find yourself sort of laughing rather at his expense, which I know saying it out loud, it sounds very, very harsh. But I think within the story, Petronius, he paints him in such an utterly unlikable light that you really can't help it, and you don't really feel too bad about doing so.
Because the thing about this is, of course, that it led on to F. Scott Fitzgerald, didn't it, and The Great Gatsby.
It did, and I never knew this. I studied this text at university, and I didn't come across this link between this book and The Great Gatsby until, I don't know, well after I'd left university, which is a shame, because actually when you read The Great Gatsby and you look at Jay Gatsby, you can see, you know, very, very strong parallels between him and this Roman prototype.
Wealthy but uncultured.
Very, very uncultured. I mean, there's even a reference, I think, in The Great Gatsby towards the end of the book where Gatsby, his career as a Trimalchio is described as coming to an end. And I think there's obviously a lot of sort of focus in the novel on the sort of the grandeur of the mansion and the marble swimming pool and the lovely parties, the entertainments and what have you. And there's this whole kind of unravelling of him. He's sort of risen up the ranks from, was he sort of brought up on a farm in North Dakota or wherever it was, and he's sort of come into wealth. And he's kind of determined to show it off. And that obviously has a very key parallel with Trimalchio, this former slave who's kind of keen to show himself to be living the high life and to show off what he's done with him, with his life and his money. And I think the main real difference is the ancient novel really, really focuses very, very heavily on the food. And this is the kind of the key thing you take away from reading this book. You're absolutely mesmerised as you read it by the number of very, very extravagant dishes which are sort of cooked up for this great dinner party. You have cakes that explode with saffron and dishes designed to resemble the signs of the zodiac.
Wow.
Kind of eggs, which aren't really eggs, they're kind of made from flour and water or something, and then you hit them with a spoon and you realise they're not eggs at all. And it's really very much sort of a feast for the senses. But I think at the same time, you have rumbling through this, you've got all this sort of profusion of wonderful things, but you've got this very, very uneasy atmosphere. And I think that's what you find in The Great Gatsby as well, isn't it?
Though Jay Gatsby's a bit more likeable, isn't he? He's portrayed as a more sympathetic character, would it be fair to say, than Trimalchio?
I think he is, yeah. I think that he's certainly a lot more likeable, particularly sort of on first meeting. He has a lot more charm than Trimalchio. But there's a whole sort of mystery about who he really is, I think, which kind of echoes and sort of permeates the book. And you kind of have the same sort of feeling about Trimalchio. I mean, who is he? Who is he becoming?
Because when you mentioned this to me, I went digging around to find out a bit more about this. And I hadn't realised that actually F. Scott Fitzgerald, he called the novel Trimalchio when he wrote the first draft, and the publishers said no.
Yes.
And rejected it.
And presumably the idea of Trimalchio wasn't a familiar name by 1925, and people hadn't remembered Petronius and Nero's Arbiter of Excellence. He's probably considered too obscure.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, isn't that interesting, everyone? I had no idea about this link. And of course, no. I mean, everyone knows about Gatsby, don't they?
I think there are so many things you learn later on. You can really delve deep into a work of classical poetry or whatever else, and you're really engaging line by line, and then you miss sort of a whole kind of layer of things.
So, I mean, there are all sorts of ways into the ancient world, aren't there? I mean, I know it probably sounds rather absurd, but I've got several favourites. Well, the Asterix books, for example, which, I mean, obviously are comic books, but they're a wonderful sort of modern comic interpretation of the Romans' behaviour through the empire. And then there's Lindsay Davis's crime fiction series set in Rome with her detective Marcus Didius Falco.
I love all the Asterix. And the other one's the Rosemary Sutcliffe books for children as well.
Yeah. In fact, next month we're issuing the fifth in her Roman and post-Roman books, Dawn Wind.
Actually, I wanted to ask you, Gail, when you were a student in Cambridge, did you ever go and see the Greek play?
No, I didn't.
So this is a thing, I think it's every 3 years, it's been going for over 100 years. I think, Daisy, do you know about this?
I do, yes.
The classically educated students, because it is in Greek, and you can go and see it. And I was very dubious about this, obviously not speaking any Greek. There are subtitles or surtitles. I went and I took my son, who was then 16, and it was absolutely fantastic. This is a theatre, a live production on a theatre stage. It was expected to be full of tweedy, old male scholars. And the audience was packed out with teenagers. It was really heartening to see. They did two short plays. I think it was Antigone and is it Lysistrata?
Yeah, Lysistrata.
That was a bit of an eye-opener, because it's effectively about a sex strike, isn't it, by women?
It is, yeah. It's a very, very modern play in many respects. And I think lots of people have to re-engage with this more recently, sort of these women deciding to go on sex strike until their husbands do what they say. And it's
Does it work?
But I'm not going to give away the ending, but it's a very, very good, very lively read. It's an Aristophanes play. But I mean, I think the Greek play in itself, I'm so pleased it's still going and that there are, you know, so many young people pouring in to see it, because it is wonderful to hear something actually spoken, hearing the sound and you're hearing the rhythm of it. And that is sort of the experience and the excitement and, you know, the real wonder of Greek theatre as people would have felt it. It's, you know, it's probably as close as we can come.
Yeah, I mean, it was so fun to watch these students just gossiping in Greek. Thoroughly recommend it. Let's hope that they can actually stage it. I think it's probably next year when it's due to happen again. Daisy, thank you. I think, you know, we're going to produce a fantastic reading list out of that lot. And, you know, I hope tempt people to open up one or two of those books that many of us, and I'm guilty of this myself, have on our bookshelves and, you know, perhaps haven't quite managed to read just yet. Will you stay with us and give us a book recommendation?
Absolutely, yes.
Before we move on, a brief word about Slightly Foxed. Elegant, eclectic and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but are often very hard to find in bookshops. Among its contributors are distinguished writers and novelists and people from other walks of life, all of whom share their passion for particular books and authors and write about them beautifully. Now, since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? £48 for an annual print subscription in the UK and Ireland, and £56 overseas. Your subscription also includes free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd rather talk to a human, give the office a ring on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. Now, before we get to book recommendations, Anna's got the latest in our Literary Expeditions series. These are suggestions for days out, when indeed we're all able to be out and about again. What have you got for us, Anna?
So this month I'm taking us to Gladstone's Library in Harden in North Wales. It's a beautiful village. I confess I have yet to visit myself, but it's very much on my list. It's UK's only residential library, and that just sounds like a very appealing prospect.
Yes,
actually.
What does that mean?
So it means that there are reading rooms. There's a collection of over 150,000 and books, pamphlets, you know, records, etc. But also bedrooms, some rooms to actually stay in. There's a restaurant, there are gardens. You can have a whole little trip away.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
And you can do so for reasons of study, or you can just do it as a little kind of residential trip for peace and quiet and for some browsing. So
you can just rent a room at this library and go there for a few days and stay and have a browse around. Is that right?
Essentially, yes. It's essentially, you know, a B&B, but that also happens to be a library. And it was built on William Gladstone's, the Liberal politician and Prime Minister, in the late 19th century. It was based on his personal library that he wanted to make available to the public. And then, you know, after his death, they made an appeal for funds to actually build the permanent building, and it's just grown since then. Yes, it's available to the public, and, you know, on those kind of liberal values, they want to make it as available and accessible as possible. So, you know, the prices are low and the collection is large. It is an independent charity, so I also thought it would be a good opportunity to mention that members of the public can actually sponsor a shelf in its Gothic reading rooms. I think you can pledge £100 or more to help get the library through the pandemic so it can open its doors once again when we can.
It sounds like a great idea. I mean, is it a political collection, Anna, just to understand what the actual content of this library is?
It's not a political collection, although there are political titles there. The foundations of the library were Gladstone's own copies of works by Homer, Dante, Walter Scott, Tennyson, which actually have Gladstone's own annotations within them. But then the collection is built, and many authors go to work there and use it as a kind of a research library, as well as, you know, there's all sorts of fiction, non-fiction. Yeah, well-stocked library.
Thank you, Anna. It sounds absolutely fantastic. I definitely want to go there when it's possible. And as you say, sponsoring a bookshelf right now sounds also like an excellent idea. book recommendations. Shall we move on and start with Steph?
I have just finished a book that has been on my shelf for a very long time. It's one of those books I've always meant to read but never got round to. It's Voltaire's Candide.
Mm.
For a book written in 1759, which is a satire on the philosophy of optimism and religion and French society, it's actually a rollicking read. It's fantastic.
It is.
It's got some terrible torture scenes in it, and all the characters have horrible things done to them, but they do survive. You can see how the book must have influenced many, many authors through the last couple of centuries. And I think there are several scenes from Monty Python that were probably based on Candide, particularly the Spanish Inquisition.
No one expects it's Spanish Inquisition.
Added bonus is that it's only 94 pages, so I would recommend anybody who hasn't read it to read it. And it ends with the lovely, simple message that what we all need to do is to cultivate our gardens and live a simpler life.
Very true in current circumstances.
Yeah, a great choice, Steph. Thank you. Gail?
Well, I'm going to recommend a novel that was published last year by Caris Bray, and it's called When the Lights Go Out. It's set in northwest England, and it's basically a novel about global warming and a cooling marriage. Emma and Chris live in a rather ramshackle, dilapidated house. She's an ex-librarian. He is an out-of-work landscape gardener. They have two adolescent sons, and it is pouring with rain. And Chris, the husband, becomes obsessed with global warming and spends his time carrying placards on the high street and stockpiling food in the garage. And meanwhile, Emma is trying to keep normal life going. It's the run-up to Christmas, so she's trying to make presents and to cook and to decorate the house. And the rains and the floods continue. The mother-in-law moves in because her caravan has been deluged with water. And she's a martyr, and she takes over their bedroom and generally gets in the way. And as the rains continue, Chris keeps turning off the heating to save the planet. And it ends with a dramatic and a very funny conclusion on Christmas Day. And I can't give away the ending, but it's basically a book about cultivating hope and weathering change. And in the current climate, I think it's an extremely good read, beautifully written, very entertaining.
It's in the same vein as Voltaire in some ways.
Yes, absolutely.
Daisy.
I'm going to recommend a classic, and it's always a difficulty when I'm asked to recommend a book because you have so many author friends who've always got books coming out and you don't want to sort of favour one over the other. So I'm going to say a classic one, which I've been rereading over lockdown because I find it very comforting, which is A Diary of a Provincial Lady by E.M. Delafield.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure lots of your listeners will have read this already, but I think it's kind of perfect actually for the kind of time we're living in. I've been trying to keep up a diary of my own. I've sort of done this for the last decade or so, but particularly at the moment. And it's just so funny. I think, you know, if you like Diary of a Nobody, it's sort of in that kind of ilk.
Yeah.
And very refreshing.
Funny enough, Daisy, we're going to be reissuing it.
Oh, really?
If not this year, then next. And we've got a wonderful article on it by Senda Maxton Graham. It is a great book, isn't it? Very, very funny.
So funny.
Well, that's very neat. Anna?
So I'm going to recommend The Emperor's Babe by Bernardine Evaristo. It's a novel written in verse, and it kind of melds poetry, history and fiction all together. It's all things at once. It's set in Roman London in 211 AD and follows Zuleika, a Nubian teenager. Her parents are Sudanese immigrants. Yeah, she's a young teenager, very bright, lively, funny, streetwise, and she's married off to an old Roman man, a rich merchant. But then she catches the eye of a Roman emperor, Septimus Severus, and becomes his mistress. And it's just, even though it's set in Roman London, it feels very modern. It kind of zips along. It's very much in her voice and in this kind of rich language with vivid imagery. And you have the world of slave girls and slums, but also these lavish villas and wealth from when she's in the world of the rich merchant and then the emperor. Long descriptions of food and largesse, but also the dirt and grime and danger of the slums. And it's also got a great supporting cast, her friend Alba, and there's a bar owner called Venus, who's a very striking character. So it's just a lot of fun. I mean, a lot of research has gone into it, but it wears it very lightly, and it just feels both very modern and ancient at the same time. You whip through it, and it's very entertaining.
I think we're going to have to get Daisy to read that and come back to us and tell us what she thinks of it.
That's one of the list, yeah.
A fantastic bunch of suggestions. Thank you very much, everyone. Varied, I think we could call that, and tempting, all of them. That is it for this month. Daisy, thank you so much for being with us. We've really, really enjoyed having you with us.
Oh, I had so much fun. Thank you.
Now, next time, we will have a true tale of buried treasure. Five decades of largely unseen writing from two great but considerably more modern poets, Ted Hughes and Seamus Heaney. Now, Dr. Mark Warmold, the Cambridge scholar who brought it all to light, will be with us. So don't miss it. For now, though, thanks for listening and for joining us on another literary expedition off the beaten track.